Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Injured at work in a motor vehicle accident or had a fall in a public space? Speak to Your Claim Lawyers, a no-win, no-fee personal injury claims law firm that specialises in maximising compensation claims for injured people. Call 1-800-YOUR-CLAIM or yourclaimlawyers.com.au.
Welcome to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
And what a great pleasure it is to have your company for another edition of This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And today we celebrate the life of a gentleman who has made his mark in the round ball code and is still making his mark as the coach or the manager, if you like, as one of the big clubs in the competition, Melbourne Victory. Kevin Muscat is his name, and I'm delighted to have him in the studio. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invite.
A busy time for you, although last week you managed to have a week off, so you wouldn't have known yourself. What was going on there?
It's been it's actually been a long time coming because the A-League now recognised an international window, international weekend, where all the international teams get to play. It's something we've been lobbying for as a club and coaches for quite some time. So it was nice to have the weekend off in relation to having all your players available for the next game. And which is important not only to the club, but I think just as important for the competition, because generally the international players are, you know, up there with the better players in the competition, and the public get to see them more often rather than get to watch games where they're not available.
It was the calm before the storm having a week off, because tonight you play Sydney, and there's always an edge to that. Every time you play Sydney, there's always an edge to it.
Yeah, there always has been, and we've built a very good rivalry against them, and that's been born out of, in the last few years, playing really important games against them. The last time we played them was a major semi-final, obviously for a place berth in the grand final. It was in Sydney, and we beat him in extra time in that unbelievable game where we conceded the goal with 13 seconds on the clock, and it was Terry Antonis who inadvertently scored an own goal and then went on to score the winner in extra time. So it was a bitter sweet, and it was the first time actually in my career I've seen many players cry on the football pitch, you know, with devastation and elation, but I've never seen a player do it twice. Yeah, he was he cried when we conceded the goal and he scored, and he cried when he scored the winner. So it was a moment that will go down in our history as an unbelievable moment.
Was it one of the more incredible games that you've ever been involved in? Because I remember watching that night and I just thought, who wrote the script for this?
Yeah, you couldn't have wrote it any better from our perspective. And you consider as well that the two goals, it was Stefan Negro who, again, he inadvertently scored an own goal. And then it was Terry Antonis scored an own goal for us. And it was one of those nights we scored five goals, but two of them for the opposition. So it was a great night. And I think it set us up really well, for the final. And considering prior to that, you know, it was a while since we'd beaten Sydney. You know, they had the wood over us, for a few games, and, you know, always in reflection and reviewing the games, thinking, you know, it's not a million miles away. It's only a matter of inches here. And it proved to be the case in the most important one in our recent history.
I mentioned in the introduction you're part of one of the biggest clubs, arguably the biggest club. Who's bigger, Sydney FC or Melbourne Victory?
It just depends on a definition, doesn't it? Because it's a debate that goes round, and, you know, I'd argue that it's difficult to answer unless you know what we're measuring. Is it trophies? Is it fans? Is it dollars in the bank? You know, what is the measurements here? And I think over a period of time, we pride ourselves on being the first. You know, for a number of things, we always want to be the first to do the next thing. And in recent years, Sydney and ourselves have dominated the trophies. I think we're about four apiece for the last, you know, three or four years. You know, if you're, depends what side of the border you're from, I suppose, and there'll be arguments from one or two other clubs also claiming that. But the reality is, for me, it's about what we do from here on in, what we do tomorrow and the next day, rather than looking backwards. It's possibly for the club and the fans to have that debate, and I'm sure it'll go on for many more years to come.
Kevin, from a coach's or manager's point of view, we talked about the importance of the game and the passion that goes into a Melbourne-Sydney game.
Yeah.
Do you need to control your players' passion and aggression and make sure that they stick to the process rather than getting caught up in the emotion of the game?
And it's something that, you know, can't be overstated because, you know, we've got a number of players that, you know, are born in Sydney. We've had, you know, we've still got some players who've played for Sydney in the past as well. So it is important and the focus or the refocus during these times about, you know, what's important for the team. Because any individual success, you know, more times than not, comes from team success. As an individual, you've got to focus and make sure that you're focused as a group on what's important for the team during that week, during that game. And then when you dissect it even further, you know, in that moment, in the next moment, and moments keep appearing, it's, you know, staying within what's important to the team. Because, you know, as you said, it's not only, you know, you've got family, if you're from Sydney in the crowd and you haven't seen for a while, that it's a bigger crowd than usual. If you're at home, there's a large number, the expectation grows. If you're away, you're in enemy territory. So there's a lot of things that go into it. And we work pretty hard on the mental side of the game because we think it's proved to be important over a period of time, and it's certainly going to be even more important going forward.
Sydney had their own marquee player going back a couple of seasons ago with Alessandro Del Piero, and he got a lot of publicity, and rightly so, because he's a great of the game. Yeah. How's Keskay Honda settling into your organisation?
Yeah, I think immediately you go back to the initial conversations that I had with him, and immediately I could see an unbelievably driven person in everything that he did. You know, we spoke not all about football, but his personal life, his business life, and the man was just incredibly driven. In the end, you know, speaking to him, it was, you know, one of the reasons, or you know, part of the reason for him coming here was that he sensed the same. You know, driving myself. You know, when I spoke about the club, you know, spoke with passion and spoke with passion about what we're trying to do, and you know how, you know how much we're driven for success here. And he hasn't proved me. He hasn't proved my thoughts wrong because, you know, he arrives. He's immediately out in the training pitch. He's, you know, one of the first to arrive. He's so diligent in what he does. It's been a breath of fresh air to see someone who's achieved so much in the game, still wanting to achieve.
You're in a position where you've got to tell him what to do because you're the manager.
Yeah.
Does it come back the other way? Does he make suggestions to you about the way that the team could be structured and the way that the team might play? And if so, do you take that on board?
It's a difficult situation. Well, not difficult. First and foremost, you know, again, it was part of the conversation that I had with Keskay. I've got a vision about, you know, how, you know, what he could contribute to the team and how we were going to play. And the most important thing is that, you know, he believes in that. Yes, you know, he's come in and, you know, his belief's been unbelievably high and his performances have shown that. There's no doubt that, you know, I speak to him and, you know, a few others that have been around the place and getting feedback. I don't live in the change room, so, you know, they're in the change rooms. They see things that I don't. They hear things that I don't. And, you know, I've had conversations with him about football. He's very inquisitive about... talking to Keskay or anybody else, I know that if things are clearer, generally it happens more often. You know, if Keskay understands his role, if Carl Valeri understands his role and the role's very clear, the execution of it is a lot easier. It's not easy, but it's easier. And I've had conversations, and he's an aspiring coach as well. You know, so he asks me sometimes, you know, why do we do this? And he's so inquisitive to, you know, to gain knowledge, and the thirst for success is unbelievable. He's away at the moment. He went away a couple of weeks ago with Cambodia. He's taken on some work there on a voluntary basis. you know, with a nation, an up-and-coming football nation, just wanting to give back to the game. So he's involving himself in a little bit of coaching as well, which is, I suppose, brings a few more questions my way.
By the sound of it, you never had any doubt about his determination to succeed, because there has been the perception with some of the players who've come and played in the A-League that it's a bit of a superannuation policy at the back end of their careers, but that was never the case with him.
If you go through our history, we've been reluctant, for the reasons that you've just mentioned, with big name players and the age of players. So there was a hell of a lot of due diligence done from myself on Keske, and there was nothing that come back that filled me with any insecurity or doubt because of those reasons. And he's brought that level of competitiveness and competition to the team, at training, whatever it is, he just wants to win, and he's got that drive, and he doesn't accept defeat lightly. There's a full inquest if he loses a 5v5. Why did it happen? Who didn't track their run? There's a full inquest that could last hours. So he hasn't shown any of that with us, and again, his performance is ultimately what people see, and that's the action that go out in the park, and I think we've all been, very impressed with his attitude.
Just a little technical term. Do you refer to yourself as a coach or a manager? Or there's so many things. I think they call them a gaffer overseas, don't they?
Yeah, it depends what part of the world you're from. We've got, Ola Toivonen, and he was in England for a while, so he calls me gaffer. Some other players call you boss. Some other players call you by name, and I don't demand to be called anything, really. There's more management that goes into the game than actual coaching. but for some reason in this part of the world, we refer to them as coaches, but I'm happy either way.
Well, on that subject, you've just formed a coaches' union.
Yes.
What was the main reason behind that? Was it to give the coaches a voice, or was it to give them security in their position?
A bit of both. A lot of both, actually. The past, as history has told us, that contracts that coaches have entered into or contracts that haven't been honoured by clubs, the number was crazy. And it was just, it was only a matter of time, that the players have got a union. It's more so that we've got the coaches have got some security and some legal representation, because there's 10 jobs in this country, 10 head coaching jobs, and then there's, assistant roles and goalkeeper coaches. Then under that, in every state, there's many coaches, and they need the support just as much as the coaches in the A-League. But over a period of time, it will grow. And we'll get a lot more stability in contracts being honoured both ways, because it's been the other way as well, where coaches haven't done the right thing. So I think it's important that the coaches, when they enter into an agreement, are respected in the right way.
Speaking of the structures of the game, Kevin. Do you think the A-League's going down the right path at the moment? There's talk of the expansion clubs coming in. Is the league ready for that?
If we're ready right now for the next season, it's possibly getting to the point where it's going to be hard very hard for the teams coming in, albeit they're preparing themselves and lobbying to get these expansions. Only a matter of time. The competition does need it. And for me, in the long run, for the game to go to the next level, the highest level, we need promotion and relegation also. Difficulties arise with all these things, but everybody, it's human nature to identify problems. It's not human nature to find solutions. Finding the solutions are a lot harder, but for me, the quicker we get to, 12 teams and 14 teams and then promotion and relegation, the better for the competition.
There's been a lot of talk that one of your old teams, South Melbourne, might be fielding a team. Would that be a bit of a pull for you? I know you're a Melbourne Victory man through and through at the moment, but down the track, would it be a lure for you to maybe coach your old team?
Yeah, I spent a great time at South Melbourne and got some really good memories. There's talk of other teams in Melbourne as well. And, it was 13, 14 odd years ago when I was in Europe, and, coming back to Melbourne was a big lure. you know, coming back to the, you know, the state that I grew up in, and the state and football that gave me so much was, you know, exciting, and that's why I decided to come to Melbourne Victory. What happens in the future? Who knows? Who knows?
We'll talk about that early part of the journey and how it all began for Kevin Muscat when we come back on the other side of the break. It is great to have the Socceroo, the Melbourne Victory coach, the manager, the gaffer here in the studio with me. More with Kevin Muscat on the other side of the break on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
And what a pleasure it is to have Kevin Muscat in the studio on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. Let's talk about the journey, Kev. Where did it all begin? It began in the old Dart. You were born in England.
Yeah. Parents, mother, mum and dad are Maltese and moved across to England as my sister was born there before myself. And then I was born in a place called Crawley. You know, just outside London, Crawley, Sussex, and immigrated, the family immigrated, you know, shortly after that. I think I was about, you know, 4 or 5 months old when we come out and started off in the, well, lived in the western suburbs of Melbourne, St Albans and Sunshine, and they were my first two clubs, actually. You know, I played for Green Gully, who was in the western suburbs, and, you know, teams of Maltese, I suppose, background. You know, back then all the football clubs really were, had some sort of backing, whether it was, you know, Greek, Croatian, Yugoslav, Maltese, and everybody tended to stick to their communities. And moved from Green Gully to another a Maltese club in Sunshine George Cross, and you know that's where I was handed my National Soccer League debut.
Just going back to Crawley for a moment, yep. I think Harry Kuehl was there not that long ago.
Yeah, changing tact a little. He was, and he was at the start. He took over last year, and at the start of this year, seemed to be getting things going relatively well there, and an opportunity come at in the same division. But at a perceived bigger club that had bigger budgets, and obviously from the last couple of weeks, more expectation because he's fallen on his sword there. But I've no doubt that Harry's got done enough in his short tenure there that he'll get more opportunities.
You talked about the ethnicity of the game when you first started.
Yeah.
It obviously provided a lot of passion around the sport, but... Yeah. In the eyes of a lot of people, it was something that was holding the sport back from developing the way it has now.
There's two schools of thought because, without doubt, you know, in the mainstream community, you know, I have no doubt that it, you know, had some pull, I suppose, in holding it back. From the other perspective, it really gave, you know, a lot of, you know, first generation, if you like, you know, Australians, that community feeling where they had somewhere to belong and belonged somewhere. And if we look back, history says that, you know, tells you that there was a number of players that have come through that system at the elite level, at the top level for the National Soccer League. Yeah, without doubt, I've no doubt in my mind that we're in a better place right now with the A-League. But it did produce, you know, a hell of a lot of players in that, from that community basis, if you like.
So who was the person who identified that Kevin Muscat had the talent to graduate from the National Soccer League to one of the biggest leagues in the world, if not the biggest league?
The pleasure, obviously, of representing the national teams at all the age groups at junior level. So, you know, we were always travelling overseas, and we were always travelling and playing against other club sides and other nations. But it was Dave Bassett, who was the manager of Sheffield United, who came out on a end-of-season trip, if you like, and played against us when the under-23s, the Olympic team. And it was through there... that was the first recognition, and he kept tabs on me, and eventually went out on trial to a few clubs, and you know, went on trial to Sheffield United, where Dave was, and just about to sign my first professional contract, and you know, he got sacked. So sort of at the start again, come back home, you know, went to the Olympics, went on a few more trials in the UK, went to the Olympics in Atlanta. And it was after that that Dave Bassett called us back. He was at Crystal Palace at this time, and they'd just missed out on playoffs to go up to the Premier League. And then I had one or two other opportunities, offers in Holland. But ultimately, his loyalty and the fact that he, you know, kept his eye on me, I thought it was the best best place for me to be. And again, went to Sheffield, you know, went to Crystal Palace and played 44 out of the 46 league games in my first season, and won promotion to the Premier League. So I suppose there was some sort of justification in my decision.
Was it a fulfilling contract monetary-wise? Because obviously you wouldn't have been on much coin back here, because in those days there wasn't a lot of cash in the game. Yeah. Did you have a look at the contract and say, blimey, have a look at this?
In the end, to be honest, the answer is no, because you know, you go across there and you know, trying to make your mark and wanting the opportunity. There wasn't really a negotiation. It was you know, I took what I was given, and I've no doubt that I would have been one of, if not the least paid players in that team. But that wasn't my motivation at the time. What ended up happening over the next season when we won promotion, I was still on this contract from the first year, and it was a part of the reason that I left in the January window of the league of the that year in the Premier League. Because then, you know, I got some runs in the board, and I went across to Wolves, where you know, subsequently, you know, earned, you know, a lot more than I was earning on my first contract. But you know, that first contract wasn't about money. It was me getting the opportunity and you know, showing what I could do.
Did you enjoy the Wolves experience, given the fact that you had experience under your belt at that stage, and so you knew a bit more about what you were getting into?
Yeah, and the fact that Wolves were a big club. I mean, Palace were in the Premier League when I left them, but Wolves were a big club trying to get into the Premier League. It's a club that's in the Midlands of England, where there's you know, Birmingham are up the road, West Bromwich Albion, who are the nearest rivals, are, you know, divided by 4 or 5 miles. So there's a it's a big club, and you know, to see them where they are now, it's justification of you know, what they were like as a club back then. And I spent 5 years there, and you know, played in playoffs. Played in, you know, 2 FA Cup semi-finals, just couldn't crack, you know, promotion to the Premier League or you know, winning one of those semi-finals in the FA Cup. But I had a great time there, a wonderful time there. My my eldest daughter, Olivia, was born there, so it still, you know, holds a place in our heart.
You talk about passion. There's no doubt that clubs like Wolves and Crystal Palace have the passion, but then you go to Rangers.
Yeah.
And then it goes up another level. Just tell us what that is like, that passion, especially between Celtic and Rangers.
Yeah, it's. I mean, you're trying. I've tried to answer this question as with as much detail as possible. The reality is, it's pretty hard to explain in words. There's a football passion naturally, but it goes a lot deeper than that, and through to religion. And once you start getting to that point, it's a fairly hostile place to play. You know, I loved living in Glasgow. I heard so much about Glasgow prior to going there, and there wasn't too much positive, you know, any feedback you got. But when I got there, I really loved it. I think the fact that I got to play with, you know, my best mate, Craig Moore. He was already there, and he'd been there for a number of years. You know, that was another big draw card for me, and I really enjoyed my time there. If anything, there's, you know, I don't know if it's regret's the right word. It's probably a bit heavy, but you know, I didn't really force myself into the team, and possibly didn't you know, play my best football. You know, I went there with a reputation of being hard and aggressive, and you know, maybe going there with the nature of their football, you know, maybe tried to change that too much and show everyone a different side of me. And you know, looking back at it now, it possibly wasn't the smartest thing to do. And but I certainly enjoyed it. We won the treble when I was there as well, so it was one of the biggest seasons, you know, in the club's history. And to see the fans and you know, what it meant to them to, you know, win the treble over their arch rivals, and you know, naturally the celebrations were, you know, etched in my memory now, without doubt.
What's the old firm derby game like? Is it just a game like no other?
Yeah, it is. I was hoping you wouldn't ask because it's strange because I got myself in the team in the first season. I think I played the first 9 games and we'd won 9 games and, you know, scored a silly amount of goals. And then the Old Firm game came up and I remember being in the room with Craig Moore because we were at home and we're in a hotel the night before the game and just about to go down for the team meeting and the phone rings. And strange because no one used the room phone, at, you know, even in those days. And Craig answered the phone and he said, the gaffer wants you to go to his room. He wants to have a chat with you. And I thought he was winding me up. I thought this is a... Anyway, I went up to the gaffer's room and he proceeded to tell me that I wasn't going to play. He's changed the team. And his reasoning at the time, Alex McLeish, was that... he wanted to play the team that beat him in the cup final the year before. And I couldn't get my head around this. I think, you know, we've won the first 9 games. I've played in, you know, all the games and all that sort of stuff. And now, you know, he's a superstitious manager. And, you know, at that point there, I just sensed a lack of trust, you know, and he didn't trust maybe my temperament, you know, and that's fair enough. I could accept that if he actually said it and was honest. But again, the next Old Firm, I managed to get myself back in the team, play 3 or 4 games, and the phone rang again, and I said to Maury, I'm not going to his room. I said, because I'll end up throwing the TV at him because he'll give me another excuse. So I just went on the bus and missed that game as well. So I didn't end up playing one. The truth of the story, didn't end up playing one, and that's life.
Is that something that you've carried through to your coaching or managerial career, that you would never do something like that, that you would never act on a superstition rather than the best interest of the team, if you like?
Well, I've no doubt that, you know, he, in his decision, he thought that was the best interest of the team. That's not what, you know, now, you know, there was that incident, there was another incident where... you don't feel that you've been, you know, spoken to honestly, and that lingers more because, you know, the truth, it's like a cut, it heals very quickly, you know, but the one where you're not being quite spoken to honestly, it lingers for a long time. And, you know, I try my hardest to, you know, when I'm speaking to the players now, to be as honest as I can every time, because, you know, I've found that players respect it more, regardless if it's, you know, good or bad news.
You talked about that reputation you carried with you as a hard player. Yeah. That's probably understating some of the criticism that was directed towards you. Do you reckon that criticism had a basis, or do you reckon it was totally unfair?
No, there's been a couple of things that have been, you know, blown well out of proportion, and the one that keeps popping up is I was voted the most hated player in the competition. Well, you know, I don't remember getting a vote. So there was clearly no vote, but it's portrayed and blown up. The comments were made after a game, Wolves v Birmingham. Stan Lazaridis, an Aussie, was with Birmingham at the time and had a running battle with one of their players for quite a number of years. And you know, he come off second best in a few challenges, and he come off second best in the result. And after the game, subsequently makes these comments, and unfortunately, have stuck around for years. Mm. And, just funny though, because Stan had his daughter, his firstborn, and they invited me to the christening. So I've had to go to the christening, and all these Birmingham teammates were there, these same guys there, and I'm thinking this is going to be a good, nice afternoon. But it's like always, you know, you take everybody away from the heat of the battle and, you know, the field, and, you know, it was you know, there was no issues at that event. We had a few beers and moved on, but in the heat of battle, people do and say strange things.
I spent a fair bit of time in the commentary box, Kevin, with a bloke called David Rees-Jones, who was a great champion for Carlton. Lovely fella.
Yeah.
Chatted to him just as we're chatting. But he was one of the prime cases of white line fever.
Yeah.
He was a different bloke when he went on the footy field. Were you like that?
Yeah, I'd say it was hugely different. Hugely different. I've not had any altercations or problems with anyone off the field throughout my career. Obviously, I've run into some trouble, and, you know, admittedly now, looking back, you know, regret and, you know, hope or wish, sorry, a few incidents didn't occur. But I always, you know, played on the edge and, you know, pushed the envelope and looked for every advantage and every opportunity. And within that, I've obviously erred a few times. And, you know, do I... that will look back and if I wasn't like that, would I have had the career that I had? Or if I wasn't like that, would I have been better or worse? And who knows? And I think you could spend too much time taking all that into consideration. I know that I enjoyed my playing career, and you know, now that older and wiser, as I said, there's, you know, one or two incidents, you know, where, you know, players have been injured that you know, you regret and maybe wish didn't happen.
Let's leave that aside and go to the last chapter of your time in England, Millwall. And you could have been on the famous stage at Wembley, but you weren't. What happened?
Maybe some would say karma. But it was actually, with Timmy, actually, because I went to, I still had 3 years left of my contract at Rangers, and Rangers were trying to balance the books at this point now after winning that treble. And on deadline day, it was as late as deadline day in England that, you know, I flew down to Millwall and agreed terms, and obviously, you know, playing in the championship. They knew what I was getting myself into. The fact that it was the World Cup window, and I thought to myself, okay, well, if I want to give myself a chance of going to that World Cup, you know, I've got to be playing regularly. And, you know, the manager made it quite clear to me that, you know, I'd have to fight for my place, and game time was going to be at a minimum. So I decided to take that opportunity. In the end, again, had an eventful year, and it was a great year for us, making the FA Cup final. And as I said, I played in it a couple before that, the semi-finals, and you know, this semi-final at Old Trafford, we beat Sunderland 1-0, and you know, I managed to get injured on this occasion, and missed the FA Cup final. And you know, immediately after that, you know, when you think of, you know, the enormity of the FA Cup, and you know, watching, you know, in Australia here, that was the one competition that was always on telly. So growing up with my dad and getting up late to watch the FA Cup final, the FA Cup games, and you know, everybody's coming over, and then, you know, if we make the final, then I get injured. And I said to Dennis Wise at the time, well, you know, I'd rather go home and start my rehab, because I just, you know, couldn't stomach being around, you know, when everybody's celebrating, and I just didn't want to get in the way and drag people down. But he made sure that, you know, what he said to me, he goes, mate, you'll lead the team out. And, you know, I've watched enough FA Cup finals. No, it's always the manager that leaves the team out. It's history. It's written into the history books. But true to his word, in the tunnel, you know, I was on crutches, and the FA were up in arms because, Wise, you can't let, you've got to lead the team out. And right in the last moment, he pushed me out. And I don't think Alex Ferguson was too impressed, because he didn't wait for me when I was on my crutches. He was he was almost sprinting off. But, yeah, ended up enjoying the day. My daughter, my youngest daughter, was there at the time. So there's some memories for her, and it was a special occasion, but, you know, United were too good for us on the night.
At the time, did it feel like a special occasion, though? You're standing there on the hallowed turf of Wembley. They're playing the national anthem. They probably sang a bye with me.
Yeah.
You know, stirring moments, but you're almost divorced from being part of it.
Yeah, you were, and we went to that FA Cup. Wembley was being renovated. So the cup final was in Cardiff.
Okay.
So we went up 4 or 5 days before the game, and, you know, Wisey, there was 3 or 4 of us that were actually injured, and he made sure we were a part of it. And albeit, you know, you're putting on a brave face for your teammates, and it's more about them. It's their day now. They're playing. We tried to stay away, and Wisey said to us, right, you can have a few beers and do what you need to do, but, you know, make sure you're here for all the meetings, and you're here for the meal times. And it was okay, but probably lubricated with a few beers, eased it through a little bit, and then, you know, got home and come home and started my rehab.
I wasn't aware, obviously, that the FA Cup was played at Cardiff.
Yeah.
It reminded me of the grand final, the AFL grand final, that was played at Waverley Park.
Okay.
And a lot of the players who played in that said didn't feel like an AFL grand final. Did it feel like an FA Cup because it was at Cardiff and not Wembley?
Well, you've had to have played in both, you know, to really, compare. You know, I played in the old Wembley, fortunately enough, in my first season, where we went through. We played Sheffield United in the playoff final. So I played at the old Wembley, and that was an amazing day, just for the sheer history and, you know, the memory, and that, you know, being at Wembley was significant. Not being involved, you know, could I compare the atmosphere? Could I compare the game? And it was totally different for me, and I think it was totally different for everyone, I suppose, because of that history.
There was plenty still to come on the big stage, but it was back at home. And when we come back on the other side of the break, we'll talk about some of those great moments you had with Melbourne Victory as a player, including that one incredible grand final where if everything could ever go right in a sporting sense, it seemed to go right on that day. That's with Kevin Muscat on the other side of the break on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
A real pleasure to have Kevin Muscat in the studio. Kev, we spoke about coming back home and the lure of coming back home to be Melbourne Victory's inaugural captain. It was a big time for the A-League and it was, in a lot of ways, make or break for the sport here in Australia.
I think so. Again, you know, I'd had a year left on my contract at Millwall and then had a number of meetings with Frank Lowy and the guys who were, you know, starting up the A-League, if you like, and just thought it was time. You know, I had a young family. I'd had a son now also who was born in Glasgow. So I think it got to that time. I'd been away for 10 years and just thought, right, you know, there's an opportunity now to go back to Melbourne, as we discussed earlier, and you know, Melbourne Victory in this case, and thought we'd give it a go. And the first year, I think there was only 8 teams and we finished 7th. And the other team was from New Zealand that finished 8th. So we were effectively the worst team in Australia. And you start to doubt yourself, you know, and think, did we do the right thing? And then, you know, obviously, you know, since then, the club's gone on from, you know, leaps and bounds and, you know, couldn't have made a better decision, really.
Could you see the difference in the levels of professionalism from the old NSL to the new A-League instantaneously, or did it take a little while to kick in?
It took a little bit of time. You know, there was certainly a level of professionalism that the NSL, the old NSL, wasn't afforded. You know, there was staff members that were full time, and there was, you know, all the players were professional and full time. So I know a lot. Some NSL clubs, National League clubs, were, you know, did have players on full time, but as an organisation, it was, you know, a full time organisation. So, and if you remember as well, the crowds, you know, we started off at Olympic Park, and it was, you know, I couldn't believe it when we're, you know, having to put, you know, house full signs up at Olympic Park, and if you would have said to me that you know, a purpose-built rectangular stadium was going to be built because of the success of ourselves and the emergence of Melbourne Storm as well. If that was going to be built in my lifetime, I wouldn't have believed you. And then to go to Etihad Stadium, where the first game there was, you know, 50-odd thousand. Mm. It set the benchmark pretty high, and I think as a club we're really proud of, you know, as I said, creating a lot of firsts in the competition and looking for the next first.
The first season might not have gone that well, but it didn't take long for the championships to come. Yeah. And you talked about Etihad Stadium, or I think it was Telstra Dome at that time.
Yes, I mean,
that perfect day. Was it perfect? 6-0?
It is, you know, now, you know, at the time I just thought, you know, a few decisions went our way and, you know, we had a good side. You know, we recruited, Gary Cole recruited, you know, really well in the off-season, got some more experience in the team. We were very young in the first year. And then, you know, looking now, you know, the way we prepare and I prepare teams, I eliminate luck. You know, because, you know, the ball bounces out and, oh, that's landed so-and-so. Well, was it luck or did he position himself there? So I'm eliminating luck a hell of a lot nowadays and working on details. And, you know, I remember that day that, you know, Fred was, you know, unplayable. You know, Archie scores 5 goals. You know, I think Fred set up all 5 of them. He's the unluckiest man. And I still speak to Fred. He was, you know, such a good man. And every time we finish up, he goes, I can't believe I didn't win, man. The match that day. And I said, well, if you set someone else up rather than Archie, you set the same bloke up 5 times. So it was a bit hard for them to go away from him, but it's a little bit of a running joke for us.
What was it like to play alongside Archie? He's been a guest on this program. Yeah. Lovely man, great ambassador for his sport.
Yeah, Archie was, and that was a thing with us. And, you know, Archie was complimented by Danny Allsop, who we struck an unbelievable relationship with. And, you know, myself, Grant Brebner and Fred, you know, struck up a good relationship in the midfield. And, you know, Roddy and Adrian Layer. And we just had, I think, some real good individuals. But Archie was, at this level, there was no one that could touch Archie for a number of years. mentioned, I was just grateful he was on my team, because he was one of those that he was so hungry for goals. And I remember Steve Bull, who played for England many times, you know, he'd miss chances, chance after chance, and, you know, his attitude, and he'd actually say, you know, I'll just work to get the next chance. And Archie was exactly the same. He just loved scoring goals, because everything that come with it, your team wins, you know, you get team success, he gets individual success. But more than that, he just loved celebrating with the crowds, and he just, you know, liked putting a smile on people's face, and he was infectious. So for a number of reasons, Archie loved scoring goals, not just for the pure goal-scoring reasons. There was many.
There were multiple championships as a player. Was the 6-0 game the one that stands out, or was there another moment that stands out for you?
Oh, the next one. The next one, looking for the next one, when's the next one? That's the one that's going to stand out, and that's the only thing that drives me. Yes, you know, it's nice to look back, and you know, when we played Sydney in the 3-0 here at Amy Park, and then, you know, but my focus is you know, purely on, you know, how we're going to win the next one, and you know, what are we going to do as a football club and as a coach manager to win the next one and give some more joy to not only the chairman and the board, but, you know, most importantly to our fans and members.
Inevitably, the body's going to slow down a bit after you've played as much football as you have. Did it really begin to take its toll towards the end? Was the pace of the game something that was troubling you?
It was, without doubt, and the game gets quicker. It's the only thing that doesn't slow up. It gets quicker, and there's different forms of pace now because, you know, people can't actually run any faster, but the way the game's played, you know, with transition, teams dropping off, making it quicker. So there's ways to speed the game up rather than individuals. In my last year, you know, I was... The coach at the time wanted me to, you know, go again. You know, I've made quite a few errors and late to a few tackles as well. But the biggest thing that the body, in terms of injuries were fine. The mind, once the mind starts thinking quicker than the body, it tells you it's enough. And that's what happened to me, because, you know, I was thinking one thing and the body just couldn't react quick enough. And that's, you know, when I said to myself, well, you know, it's an injustice to everybody around me, and, you know, thought it was the right time to give up.
So you say you were late to tackles. There are obviously...
Well, some will say I was late to tackles right through my career.
Yes, but... I was going to mention that. But when the body is slowing down, you would classify it more as yourself just slowing down a little bit and being late to tackles rather than the vitriolic nature that some people still had on you. And perhaps that was a hangover from what we spoke about before.
No doubt that it was a hangover. But I know myself, and obviously, you know, going into tackles and thinking, you know, well, I can get to things, or might have previously got to things, and then, you know, all of a sudden you find a situation where you can't stop or you can't pull out, and you know, that occurred in that last season for me one too many times, and you know, I just wasn't, you know, reasonably proud person as well, and just didn't sit right with me that I couldn't give my teammates what they expected, and more importantly, you know, I didn't live up to my own expectations.
At the end of playing, was it always going to be coaching for you? Did you make some mental notes along the way that would take you down that path?
Yeah, I did. I wish I did a lot more. You know, I wish I'd, you know, had the pleasure of working some really good managers, and then trying to remember back things and creating your own philosophy as well, and, you know, how I think the game should be played. I started doing my coaching badges and licences throughout that period of time in my off time. I'm a student of the game. I'm always watching football. I wanted to be involved in some capacity, and initially I thought, well, there's nothing that's going to repeat or be as good as playing. You know, that's a given. And I thought to myself, well, you know, what's the next best? And the next best for me would be, you know, controlling a team, being in charge of a team, and managing people. And that's why I decided to get into coaching.
Was it a frustrating time for you when the management changed a fair bit, but you were assistant coach for quite a while? Or did that actually, do you think, stand you in good stead for where you are now?
I think it was a blessing for me because, you know, fast forwarding to Ange coming, Ange Postecoglou joining, that was, you know, it really opened my eyes up, because my perception of what coaching and management was totally changed under him. You know, I'd seen him work you know, so many more hours than anyone else I'd seen. I'd seen the detail that he worked under. I'd seen, most importantly for me, he come in and had to organise and reconstruct the team and the way it played from scratch. And that was a blessing for me to actually watch and be involved, because you know, he certainly, you know, put me out of my comfort zone quite a bit, which fast track I think my career.
So Ange has gone from being Melbourne Victory coach to the national coach. Yep. Is that something you aspire to down the track?
Without doubt. I've not shied away from that. I tell the younger players in our team, you know, reach for the stars. You know, whatever that looks like to you, reach for the stars. And you know, if you fall somewhere short, you'll be satisfied. And I'm no different to, you know, I'd love to manage the national team one day. It was the, you know, as a player, it's the you know, most humbling experience and most satisfying experience representing your nation. So I'd love to do it as a coach as well, and coach overseas at some point as well. So let's just see how it goes. I understand there's a process for all that to happen. You've got to be good at what you're doing now to be able to get those opportunities. So that's where all my focus is.
How do you think your old mate and adversary Graham Arnold will go in the top job?
I'm interested to see how he goes. Obviously, he's had a few games now, and the defence of our Asian Cup, you know, we won it here on home soil a few years ago. It's only weeks away now, the start of the Asian Cup. But look, I've no doubt that, you know, Graham's matured you know, a hell of a lot since he had the reins many years ago. His ideology and his philosophy on the game, he's really visual now about how he wants his teams to play and getting the team to execute that, you know, we've seen firsthand with Sydney. So, you know, I wish him well. And, you know, I think he's got the attributes to make us successful.
We're just about out of time. We'll take our final break. There is a couple of matters that I want to talk about. I want to talk to you about one bloke who is also a former guest on this program, and I still can't work out your relationship with him.
Okay.
John Cosmina is his name. We'll talk about that when we come back on other side of the break. Kevin Muscat is here. Our final segment on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funeral, Celebrating Lives, coming up after the break.
Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
Our final segment in what's been a very enjoyable chat with Melbourne Victory coach Kevin Muscat. Now, I flagged it before we went to the break. I'll ask you the question that I asked Cozzy when he was on the show. And I think I phrased it something like, I can't really work out whether you're best mates or whether you want to kill each other. What's closer to the truth?
Well, when I'm playing against him, there's no doubt I wanted to kill him, without doubt. I'm pretty sure he would have said the same thing. Have Cozzy and I got an issue? Certainly haven't. You know, we've met each other many times since a couple of eventful encounters we had. You know, the pushing off the chair and Cozzy grabbed me around the throat. I thought it was great theatre. Cozzy got sent off, and the picture of him walking away. Till this day, I've had the conversation with him every time. I said, Cozzy, tell the truth. You held the ball underneath you, and therefore I had to give you a nudge trying to get the ball back. He denies it and says, no, I was getting it to give it back to you. You pushed me. So we agree to disagree on that one. But we haven't got an issue. And, you know, Cozzy's a fierce competitor. And, you know, I remember, you know, remotely, you know, the back end of his career, he was an unbelievable competitor and, you know, didn't take a backward step. And his management style was exactly the same. There was a lot of rivalry with Adelaide, you know, South Australia and Victoria that stemmed from, you know, other codes. And Cozzy and I suppose were just the two at the time that we used to build up this rivalry in our code, and he lived up to it and so did I, and there was a few fireworks, but certainly hasn't got any issues with John.
All right, if your relationship is good with...
I hope he said the same thing.
He did, yes. It was very much almost word for word what you just said, so I don't know whether you're reading from the same script or not. One relationship that is under the microscope at the moment is that between yourself and Ernie Merrick.
Yeah.
I'll ask you, where does it sit?
Well, the reality is, I mean, we've not fallen out. We've not spoken to each other. There was contact when Ernie left the football club, and there really hasn't been a falling out, and there's not a relationship. And again, you know, I thought, you know, in the last couple of occasions, you know, we've performed really well against them, and then, you know, it's not the football that gets spoken about. It's, you know, the relationship once again, and maybe it's, you know, I don't know, call me, you know, whatever you want. I can't understand why it's made, you know, a big deal when it shouldn't. Yes, we've enjoyed some good times. It's all in the past. Together, and we had some really good times as a group. Just Ernie, as he said, he moved on, and the relationship stayed as it is.
Let's push that one aside. I want you to compare. What's it like? What's better, winning a championship as a player or winning as a coach? What's more satisfying?
When you're a player, you know, when I played, it was, you know, celebration with your peers, and, you know, you put in a lot of hard work. The satisfaction that I got winning the first championship as a coach was far greater for me, because I recognised, you know, you're in your own bubble when you're a player, and you can't wait to, you know, where are we going tonight? You know, what's happening during the week? It's all about you and the group. Whereas as a coach, you know, seeing what the board, you know, the levels that they win, the chairman, you know, Anthony DiPietro and his board, seeing the staff throughout the week and pre-season, you know, selling memberships and working closely with them. And I realised one thing that was totally, you know, new to me. It meant just as much to everyone else in the club that it did to the players. Where when I was a player, I didn't recognise that at all. You're just caught up in things. But just to sit back and see, you know, the amount of work everybody else has put in, not only the playing group, not only the football staff, but, I mean, everybody, and what it meant to them, you know, really, for me, gave me a hugely greater satisfaction winning it as a coach.
Final note, Kevin, we've talked a lot about your achievements and the many great achievements that you've had both as a player and a coach. And we've also talked about the reputation that you have. Mm-hmm. As you look back on your career, do you care what people think?
Look, I was, now that my kids are getting a little bit older, and there's just a sense of, as I said earlier, there's a few incidents that, you know, I wish didn't happen. Yeah, you know, and you can't take it back. You know, what you can do is own it and respect that. And as I said, wish that they didn't occur. I'll stand by one thing though. That you know, if I was in a team, you know, I didn't go to work or training or play a game to make friends. I went to win football games. And if I can walk back into any of the clubs that I've played for, and I'll be welcomed with open arms, because as far as I'm concerned, I wasn't there to impress any other club, any other players. I was there to be loyal to my football club and be respected by my peers in my club. And, you know, I still stand by that now, but there's an element of, you know, things will stick, you know, from my playing days, and that's something I can't change, and that's part of it. I'm just going to have to live with it, and I certainly enjoyed that time, but now I suppose the kids are growing up, and it's a totally new challenge for me in my stage of life.
It's been brilliant to sit down with you and discuss all of those things. I appreciate your honesty over the last hour or so, but let's not lose sight of the fact that it was a brilliant career, both as far as playing and the management side of things. One last supplementary question. As I said, you're playing Sydney tonight.
Yep.
Which game do you want to win more now? Do you want to beat Sydney more, or do you want to beat City more?
Because we're playing Sydney tonight, it's an easy question. Sydney.
Good luck.
Thanks very much. Cheers, Pete.
It's great to have Kevin Muscat as my guest on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be back same time next week with another edition of the program. Hope you can join us then.
Want to witness the world's biggest football game? Head to iCanWin.com.au, predict Australia's score with a crystal ball, and it could be you and a friend at the FIFA World Cup Qatar 2022 semi-finals, all thanks to McDonald's. Maccas, together and loving it. TNCs apply.